Hey everyone, this is Elijah Johnson with financeandliberty.com, and back with us today is James Corbett from the Corbett Report. James, thank you so much for joining us today.
Well, thank you so much for having me on, Elijah. I always appreciate our conversations.
All right. Well, you recently wrote an article about the rivalry, it seems like, what is going on between the U.S. and China, and you discussed various reasons why you don't buy that this rivalry is actually real. You think it's all a setup. Did you want to discuss a little bit about this?
I would love to discuss about this because I think it's exceptionally important going forward as this idea about a new Cold War takes shape in the 21st century, and the idea that the U.S.-China economic and military rivalry is going to be dominating the headlines more and more in coming years. I think we have to understand the reality that underlies this. And I think we should preface this conversation by saying that I don't want to make something too simplistic of this argument. I want to put out on the table right up front that I do recognize and I do admit the reality of various aspects of this rivalry that really is taking place right now, economically, militarily, politically. There really is a rivalry that is represented by various players in the respective governments of the United States and China, in their military, in business, in finance. There are a lot of people who really do see this as a real rivalry and are working in various ways to promote the interests of one or the other side in this rivalry. I think that is really taking place. But I think there is a deeper level of analysis that is ultimately, in the long run, going to be more important for parsing out what is really happening in this so-called rivalry. And that relies on the concept of a power behind the throne, which isn't a concept that should be very shocking or unfamiliar to students of history who will know that this is a well-documented phenomenon. I mean, for every Louis XIII, there was a Cardinal Richelieu as the power behind the throne. And for students of history, they'll also know that Cardinal Richelieu had his own power behind the throne, Père Joseph, the eminence Greece. So there can be multiple levels of powers behind the throne. So again, this is a well-documented historical phenomenon. But also for keen observers of our modern era, this should not be a particularly shocking idea, because we see, and it's something that I've documented a lot in my work at the Corbett Report, this idea of these certain players, identifiable people who continue to wield power in the nexus, for example, in Washington, inside the Beltway, through administration after administration after administration, even long after they're out of the positions of direct political influence. And I often point to individuals like Henry Kissinger or Zbigniew Brzezinski, who are identifiably still nexused into that Washington inside the Beltway power politics and still do advise the State Department and wield a great degree of influence in Washington, despite the fact they haven't been technically in positions of political, direct political influence for decades. And that's the type of the type of structure that I think is more important to looking at and parsing this rivalry, rather than looking simply at the people who are in positions of political power at the moment in this sort of cartoon version of reality where President Obama is some sort of, you know, hero on Mount Olympus making all the decisions for the country. Of course, it is more nuanced than that. And there are various organizations and bodies and players behind the scenes that are setting a longer term agenda. And it's in that longer term agenda that I think we can identify the idea that this rivalry that we see taking place at one level is in fact cooperation at another level between pairs of linked oligarchical interests in both the United States and China, and in other countries around the world as well. But obviously for the U.S.-China relationship, those would be the identifiable and operative partners in this. And these people, who include Henry Kissinger and Zbigniew Brzezinski and David Rockefeller and other well-known names, as well as less well-known names to the West on the Chinese side, these people have more in common with each other than they do with their nominal countrymen. And this is, again, something that we can even find from their own writings. I mean, for example, famously, David Rockefeller wrote on page 405 of his own memoirs, "Some even believe that we, the Rockefeller family, are part of a secret cabal working against the best interests of the United States, characterizing my family and me as internationalists and of conspiring with others around the world to build a more integrated global political and economic structure, one world, if you will. If that's the charge, I stand guilty and I am proud of it. So again, quite direct admission of that. And I think the underlying point was actually stressed in 1969 by Zbigniew Brzezinski in his book, Between Two Ages, America's Role in the Technotronic Era, where he wrote that, quote, the nation state as a fundamental unit of man's organized life has ceased to be the principal creative force. International banks and multinational corporations are acting and planning in terms that are far in advance of the political concepts of the nation state, end quote. And this is, I think, the way that we can identify what is really happening here. This is not ultimately about nation states competing with each other. It is about an oligarchical, hierarchical power structure that exists above and beyond the politics of the nation states that are, in fact, puppeteering us towards a system in which those oligarchical families on both the U.S. and the Chinese side will be able to consolidate and expand their power at the expense of a great deal of Americans and Chinese people at the lower levels, and people who may never actually understand what is happening, because a lot of these deals and backroom agreements are taking place out of sight and out of the view of most of the public.
Those quotes you read were very insightful, and you talked about in your article that it seems like the powers that be and the U.S. and China are trying to move towards a world government. Did you want to give some more specifics on why you have come to this conclusion?
Well, I think there's a couple of different ways that we should work at approaching this. And one is to talk about the concept of global government in general, and the other is to look at how this is being nexused in specifically through this Chinese-U.S. faux rivalry that I think is cooperation at a different level. I think the overall agenda towards the establishment of something like a global government is self-evident in the proclamations of people like Rockefeller and others that we just read. And I think it should be self-evident the reasons for that. Again, I think that this, for students of history, the idea that people in positions of power ultimately lust at after the idea of ultimate power, i.e. control of the globe, again, should not be particularly surprising, as we've seen tyrants and would-be tyrants of all stripes and varieties having fallen prey to that mentality in past eras from the Roman Empire onwards. I think, however, when we're talking about global government in this current context, I think it's a more nuanced idea. I don't think it's necessarily our idea of what global government would look like, as in the United Nations or something being a global parliamentary body setting the laws and regulations for the entire world. I think it's probably more of an the image we should be looking at is something more like the World Trade Organization, the International Monetary Fund, these types of international bodies that set policies, guidelines, frameworks, international legal conventions behind the scenes and out of sight, so that most people don't really have any idea what the World Trade Organization, for example, is doing on a day-to-day basis. But people who are working internationally and in the international corporate and financial structures have to know about these types of policies, white papers, guidelines, and legal agreements that are being worked on, and trade agreements and things like that that are administered by bodies like this. I think that's really the idea of the global government that these people are ultimately trying to bring in, because again, I think it serves the interests of this sort of corporate, bureaucratic, financial, technocratic class more so than our traditional concept of power as being a political sort of thing. Again, I think if we're looking at a class of individuals that don't necessarily wield political power in the traditional sense, they're looking to consolidate their power in other ways. And I think that the bodies like WTO, IMF, etc., are more reflective of that aspiration. Now, how does this nexus in specifically with China and what's happened there over the past century? I mean, there's a lot to take into account. And obviously, I mean, the establishment of the Communist Chinese Party and the establishment of the ensconcement of that party in power in China in the late 1940s is an exceptionally important piece of that puzzle, and one that that I have only done tentative work on at the moment. And I think the most interesting piece of the puzzle that I've found so far is one that I highlighted in a recent podcast I did on China and the New World Order, where I looked at the Yale, in fact, bragging about the fact that they Yale was instrumental in helping to bring Mao to greater national prominence back in the early days before he had actually accomplished anything militarily. So this comes, in fact, from an edition of the Yale Daily News from February of 1972, where basically it's an article entitled Yale Group Spurs Mao's Emergence. And it's talking about how Yale in China, which was a kind of a Yale-sponsored outgrowth of Yale that was operating in China in the early part of the last century, was instrumental in making Mao sort of a national figure by giving him prominence. They actually allowed him to edit the Yale Journal for a period of time when he was still sort of making his mark and rising up through the ranks. An interesting little nexus into that, or a window into that nexus of power between the U.S. and China in this so-called faux rivalry, because it's Yale is, of course, the home of Skull and Bones, the very famous fraternity, which, of course, produced both George Bush and John Kerry quite famously in the 2004 election. It was Bonesman versus Bonesman, a group that produces 15 graduates per year at Yale. Somehow, both presidential candidates in 2004 were in this extremely small selection of people. But also, every single ambassador to the to China from the establishment, the normalization of political diplomatic relations between the U.S. and China from Nixon all the way through to the first Bush presidency, every single ambassador except for one was himself a member of Skull and Bones who attended Yale University. So there's an interesting connection there that actually gets even deeper, because when you start to look at some of the other ways that the U.S. and China oligarchy nexus is in China, you'll start to encounter the stories of people like Cornelius van der Staar, the founder of C.V. Starr and Company, which even in their own PR materials, they brag about him as a pioneer of globalization, who set up his first insurance venture in Shanghai in 1919, which was an incredible accomplishment. I mean, it would be an incredible accomplishment even in our modern era, but to think of that happening a century ago, it was quite amazing that he was able to do that. And of course, that became the nexus, the seed from which AIG sprang. So now we have, going down through the generations, of course, Maurice Hammering Hank Greenberg was the CEO and chairman of AIG for a significant period of time. He's now retired, but he is now the chairman and CEO of C.V. Starr and Company. And just a few years ago, he was instrumental in helping to donate $50 million to Yale to expand their operations in China. So again, there's a lot of different ways that nexus is in, but it really starts to come to a head in the 1970s at the time of the normalization of relations, when Henry Kissinger, of course, precedes Nixon to China and opens up the possibility for the normalization of relations between the U.S. and the communist Chinese. And it's in that era, in the 1970s, when Mao starts to basically lose or to be shoved off to the sidelines of power and eventually dies. Of course, Deng Xiaoping takes over the reins, and it's under the influence of Deng Xiaoping and this new generation of communist upstarts, I guess, that we start to see a significant shift taking place. And this is a shift towards the sort of opening of the Chinese economy and the foundation of a lot of the building blocks of what became the big Chinese dragon of the past couple of decades. So it's at that time we saw, for example, the formation of CITIC, the Chinese state investment vehicle, which ended up, which started quite small, but ended up investing hundreds of billions of dollars around the world ultimately. And that was in the hands of various people like Rong Yiren, who was regularly meeting and even courted people like Henry Kissinger to be advisors to CITIC Group. So again, in that era of the 1970s into the 1980s, we saw an incredible concerted effort to basically open up relations between the U.S. and China economically in a way that started cementing various relations that we saw come to fruition in the late 1990s, where all of a sudden we started seeing massive inflows of investment, especially including R&D investment, not just setting up of factories, but actual R&D, corporate branches, even headquarters in Beijing, in China generally, from some of the largest corporations on the planet, including Microsoft and HP and just you name it. It's like a who's who of the Fortune 500 all began flooding investment into China in the 1990s. And then over the past decade and a half, we saw this remarkable rise of the Chinese dragon economy. So I think we have to understand this incredible rise of China over the past decade and a half, which now, according to at least purchasing power parity evaluation of GDP, places the Chinese economy over the U.S. It's now officially the number one largest economy in the world when measured in purchasing power parity. That did not just happen overnight. That did not happen by coincidence. That happened as the end point of a concerted series of agreements, deals, and business transactions that took place over the course of decades that was spearheaded by the Rockefellers and Kissingers and Brzezinskis and others who have admittedly been part of this plan towards the ultimate internationalization, the globalization, the end of the nation-state system.
And another sign that you discussed in your article that is more recent is the fall in the oil price. You said that the Saudis, at the behest of the U.S., actually drove the oil prices down, and now the Chinese are actually the ones who are benefiting from this.
Well, this is a fascinating little piece of this puzzle, because I'm not a mind reader. I don't have access to the backroom deals that have been taking place with the Saudis and the U.S., so I'm not claiming any sort of knowledge of how this deal was structured or for what particular purpose, but we can see the results of this recent plunge in oil price. So for those who don't know, it's been widely reported in the mainstream, in The Guardian and other mainstream publications, that the recent plunge in oil price is the direct result of an agreement that was reached between John Kerry and his Saudi Arabian counterpart earlier this year, where basically the U.S. Agreed to help bomb Saudi Arabia's enemies in Syria in return for Saudi basically opening the spigot, pumping oil, and driving down the price of oil, which presumably, at least at one level, it certainly does counteract and undermine various enemies of the U.S. State Department. Obviously, Russia, Iran, Venezuela, all requiring a certain break-even point in their national budgets for the upcoming year in order to basically be able to fund their operations. So, for example, I mean, the Russian government is hoping for $100 oil in order to fund its 2015-2016 budget. Obviously, it's not going to come anywhere near that, and that's going to have we've already seen with the recent plunge in the ruble and the rate hike by the Russian National Bank, the kind of devastation that's having on the Russian economy already. So on one level, this is quite a straightforward deal that makes sense in terms of the United States. Basically, you scratch our back, we'll scratch yours with Saudi Arabia, and everything is working out in that realm. But there are different ways that you can view this deal, because, for example, one of the effects of this plunging oil price, now down under $60, heading down, there doesn't seem to be a floor. Bank of America predicting that oil price may reach $50 in the coming months. That really starts to painfully claw away at the various gains that have been made in the U.S. Shale oil and gas markets in recent years, and threatens to shake out some of the shale producers that require anywhere between $60, $70 is their price point at which they can actually sustain their operations. At any rate, it looks like we're heading below that, and this might start to shake out some of that production, which seems to be self-defeating for the United States. Why would the United States be interested in driving out some of its own producers, which for years and years the U.S. has been talking about energy security and trying to basically stop relying on foreign oil? Well, for the first time, they're actually achieving that because of this shale revolution. And now here we have the plunging oil price that's threatening to overturn that. So it doesn't seem that it's an unmitigated good for the United States. And it's difficult to pinpoint who this deal would be an unmitigated good for, except for massive oil importers, like the world's largest oil importer, of course, the Chinese, who are basically enjoying the benefits of this fire sale that's going on right now, and has already committed to expanding their reserves over the course of the coming year. They're going to start adding to those reserves, even above what they were already planning to add, as much as 700,000 barrels a day. That's a significant amount of oil that China is now starting to stock up and will be adding to their national reserves at very, very cheap prices. This deal, ultimately, the biggest winners are probably the Saudis, who still get to continue to sell their oil, even if it's at a reduced rate. They still have no lack of buyers for their oil. But also, I think the Chinese are going to be a big winner of this as they start to stock up. So I can't say that precisely that this was necessarily aimed at benefiting the Chinese, but it is the logical conclusion of what we're seeing, and it certainly is happening that the Chinese are the big winners. Russia is a big loser. The U.S. has some benefits, but some losses. I mean, the Chinese really seem to be the ones who are making off in this deal the best out of all of the players.
I wanted to move now to another subject you talked about in your article. You said that the International Monetary Fund is considering adding the yuan to their basket of currencies, which makes up the IMF's SDR currency. Did you want to discuss the significance of this?
Yes, the SDR is special drawing rights, which is not really, it's not a currency in the traditional sense. It's not something that you or I could ever actually trade in. It's not something that's used in daily transactions. It is only something that is held by central banks as a reserve currency. So anyone who is holding an SDR basically has the right to a claim to an equivalent amount of US dollars, Japanese yen, euros, or British pounds. Those are the four currencies that are currently in that basket that comprises the value of the SDR. So it's kind of like an equivalency currency that can be held by nations that could be converted into any one of those four. It can be used to make a claim in any one of those four currencies. And it's just a reserve currency that's held by the central banks. So this is used for settlement of accounts in international trade. And it's, again, one of those types of institutional systemic features that you and I and the average person will never see or never encounter and never deal with, but is actually undergirding to a certain extent the international financial system. And increasingly so, I think it will be in coming years, the SDR will be an increasingly important part of international trade. And I think the interesting part of this is every 5 years they have a review of basically the two main factors: A, what currencies will be in that basket, and then B, how much the SDR will be worth in relation to those currencies, because, you know, one SDR is equal to whatever, $0.5 or whatever it is. They evaluate that every 5 years. So the next evaluation is due for next year. And back in 2010, at the last evaluation, the Chinese were, and the Bank of the governor of the Bank of China was openly advocating for the idea that the Chinese yuan should be added to the SDR basket. It should be basically thought of as an important enough currency that it would be seen as one of the pillars of this special drawing rights currency. And so there was some lobbying with regards to that. But at that time, the IMF said that basically it wasn't freely convertible enough. The yuan, of course, there are still restrictions on its convertibility, and it's still pegged to the dollar and things of this sort. So it wasn't seen as basically a stable enough currency and a currency in its own right in order to bother putting it in the SDR basket. However, next year will be the next assessment for the SDR basket, and the IMF is considering the Chinese yuan, and there are ample clues or signs that they are seriously considering adding the yuan to the basket, including, of course, the fact that the yuan is now much more freely convertible than it was 5 years ago. Freely traded in Hong Kong, in Singapore, in Frankfurt, in London, and elsewhere around the globe, where there are trading opportunities opening up directly with the yuan. And also, we've seen the emergence of the so-called dim sum bond market, which is now valued anywhere between $79 and $120 billion are the numbers that are thrown around. But those numbers have basically come up in the last few years. A few years ago, it was basically a non-existent market. Now we have $120 billion market that's now being priced in yuan. So it's a significant market. It's becoming more significant. And of course, in the last 5 years, we've also seen the Chinese yuan become the second most used currency in international trade settlement, which is a very fine distinction. In fact, if you look into it, it doesn't mean that the yuan is necessarily one of the most important currencies in the world, but it's another indicator that the yuan is increasing in importance. So all of this makes for a pretty convincing case that that it will be added to the SDR basket in 2015. And I think this is significant because I think that the most likely contender for the next world reserve currency is not the US dollar, obviously, which I think we can all see is being eclipsed, but it is not being eclipsed by any particular currency. There isn't a single competitor currency that could eclipse or take the place of what the US dollar is in terms of having a large enough economy, a strong enough, more developed enough markets, and the credit worthiness or the perception of credit worthiness that is necessary for a world reserve currency. That really does raise the question, well, if the US dollar is seen to be in decline in terms of its position of prominence, then what could replace it? And I think that the obvious logical answer to that, and something that has been proposed with increasing frequency in recent years, is this special drawing rights currency administered by the International Monetary Fund, which is not a single currency, but a basket of currencies. And if the yuan is added to that, of course, it will make the yuan an exceptionally important part of the coming financial world order. And I think the real significance of this is that in every previous era of history, we have seen it has always been a single imperial power with economic and military prominence that has been the keeper of the world currency. So in the era of Pax Americana, ever since the Bretton Woods Agreement in 1944, it has been the U.S. dollar, of course, backed up by the U.S. government and the U.S. military and the U.S. financial markets. Before that point, it was the British Empire. Before that, it was the French. Before that, it was the Dutch. Before that, it was the Spanish. I mean, you can go back all the way to Roman times to look at various currencies that have been used in international settlement. But in every single one of those cases, it was a singular imperial power. But we are facing the idea in the coming years that it will be a basket of currencies administered by the International Monetary Fund that will replace the US dollar as the world reserve currency. And that in and of itself is an example of this type of process of globalization that we're talking about, because it is not a single nation state that will be administering that or in any way determinative in that process. It will be a basket of currencies. It will be a number of different nations that are grouped together as sort of the multipolar world becomes a very real reality in international trade and international financial relations. And I think that is significant because that's the exact type of globalization that we're talking about. And in that case, both China and the US will sort of be in the same boat. And I think by design.
Right. And you mentioned in your article that if this occurs, you said, quote, an unaccountable global institution like the IMF will be the key determinants of our economic life. Did you want to discuss a little bit about this?
Well, the important thing to keep in mind about organizations like the International Monetary Fund, like the United Nations, like the World Trade Organization, all of these organizations in some ways profess their political legitimacy so that they'll pretend, for example, to be like the United Nations General Assembly, the parliament of the world in some sense, that everyone has a say in this, and it's kind of a something that at least resembles our sort of democratic system and all of this. So there's that type of rhetoric that is put behind this. But in reality, you and I and the people that we interact with on a daily basis have no real direct input into these organizations. These are all people that are appointed by the governments that we supposedly elect. So even if we do believe that we have some sort of real control over our national governments, then it's still a level of remove from our input to the people who actually make up these bodies. And these bodies, of course, are setting these types of these various financial structures, like a special drawing rights as a potential world reserve currency that, again, you and I will never interact with or experience directly, but which will be determinate factors in international trade, in international relations, ultimately, which, of course, does rely on international trade, so that the IMF can decide that China, the Chinese yuan, shall be included in the basket, thus making the Chinese yuan a more important currency just by default, just by the IMF's decree. And you and I will have no say over that. And probably, for the most part, it won't even be recognized by most of the people on the planet. I think this is the vision of globalization that we're staring at, and which is increasingly being enacted by the International Monetary Fund, by the World Trade Organization, by the G20, which, interestingly enough, just rubber-stamped a proposal by another very shadowy body called the Financial Stability Board, the FSB, which was set up originally, I believe, by the G8 in the wake of the Lehman Brothers collapse, and is now working on various white papers and policy regulations that determine various banking standards and practices that are then implemented by, for example, the G20. And the most recent G20 just saw the rubber stamping of a proposal that would basically enact the Cyprus bail-in scenario as a standard for the G20 nations, so that in the event of a wide-scale banking panic or banking collapse, it would be the depositors who would be on the hook for the debt owed by that banking entity. Which is should be a very scary thing for a lot of people who are concerned about the stability of the banking system and what we saw in 2008, the near collapse of the banking system. People should be very concerned about this precedent for their deposits to be confiscated and used to bail in the banks, exactly as happened in Cyprus. Well, those types of deals are being worked on. The regulations are being hammered out by bodies like the Financial Stability Board. They're being rubber stamped by the G20, and most people have never heard of this type of deal, let alone the implications of it. So this is, I think, something that we should be very concerned about. And even if you don't subscribe to this idea that the Chinese and U.S. oligarchies are working together or what have you, at any rate, things like the Financial Stability Board and these white papers, these are real phenomena that are happening. And if we don't know about them, that's very much to our detriment, because there really needs to be some sort of way that we can have some sort of determinative power over these types of policies if we want to have any say over what's happening in the international economic and financial structures. And at this particular time, that's demonstrably not happening.
Right. So the thing we need to do right now is to inform the public. So how should we go about doing this?
Well, the ideal, of course, is at this particular juncture in history, we have this remarkable technology for disseminating information, something that has never been really feasible, even thinkable before in human history, which is, of course, the internet and the power that it affords the average citizen to not only receive, but also send information instantaneously, globally, for next to zero price. The vast majority of the world's population is now online in one form or another, even if it's only by mobile device in certain areas of the globe. But still, there are now literally billions of people interacting online in the world's largest conversation, which has its potential drawbacks, and there are potential downsides, but there are potential incredibly empowering ways that we can work together to, for example, collaborate and share information and vet and source information and participate in open source communities that share the information and vet it and analyze it and discuss it. These types of conversations would have been literally unthinkable even a couple of decades ago. So we are at really a pretty amazing point in human history where we can counteract, at least potentially, the machinations of a shadowy behind the power type of oligarchy that is trying to enact these types of agreements and regulations. However, having said that, of course, if the internet is one of the sort of focal points for the dissemination of this information, then of course it is also going to be a focal point for the potential shutdown of the dissemination of this information. And it's interesting to note on this very point, as I did note in that article that you're referencing, China and the U.S. Frenemies with Benefits, that recently in Washington, we just saw the 7th China-U.S. Internet Industry Forum that featured as a keynote speaker Liu Wei of the Ministry of the Cyberspace Administration of China. And Liu Wei is probably not familiar to most of the listeners or most of the people in the Western world, but since taking over the cyberspace administration in China, he has been responsible for not only overseeing the Great Firewall of China, which, of course, I'm sure everyone knows about, which does some pretty amazing real-time censorship of the Chinese internet so that search results are automatically filtered and screened and et cetera in real time. But also he's begun even extending the capabilities of this rather remarkable censorship regime to include a crackdown on social media, including basically reining in various celebrities and others on the Chinese social media that were in recent years beginning to start various forms of political activism that were taking off in China. We've seen a crackdown on that recently. We've also seen the implementation of new rules by which anyone who is found to be spreading false rumors about the Chinese government, of course, false rumors as determined by the Chinese government, to anything over 500 followers online can be jailed for that offense. So this is the person who is now speaking at international cooperation forums with the U.S. internet industry that is co-sponsored by the Microsoft Corporation, of course, and the Internet Society of China, which is an interesting NGO that it works with, is supported by the Chinese government, and actually has a self-disciplinary regulation that they've put together, which is basically a pledge that anyone who signs this pledge will agree to censor, you know, their internet in accordance with China's wishes, et cetera, et cetera. You can read this actual pledge online. And of course, this is the exact pledge that is adhered to by the Microsoft China and Yahoo China and Google China and all of these other Chinese branches of the U.S. internet industry. So we already see the cooperation going on between the U.S. and China on this precise note of internet, of the internet itself, and the potential censorship of the internet. And we've seen in recent years people like Senator Joe Lieberman calling for Chinese-style censorship of the U.S. internet, and the idea that the president should have a kill switch of the internet. Again, that's Lieberman's words. So we've already seen this idea starting to float that there should be greater cooperation and even Chinese-style censorship that is now an idea that is actually being floated by U.S. politicians. I think it's something we have to be concerned about if there really is a coordinated effort to basically merge the oligarchies of these various countries in this sort of globalization. And if the only way that we have to counteract this is the internet, I think we would be naive to think that the internet as it exists right now as a free tool for dissemination of information is going to stay that way for very long.
So besides the internet, are there other ways that we can help to get people informed?
The process of spreading information is difficult. I think the idea in recent years that has been obviously most obviously fostered on the internet, the viral spreading of information, is a difficult thing to predict or to promote. It's difficult to engineer that phenomenon, and it really does depend on the tastes and the fascination of the public. So it's difficult to say how best to disseminate this. Again, I think the internet is the technology for doing that, but the way that that will be done probably just depends on the various ways that people are able to process and internalize this information. There is going to be people out there who are going to put this in much simpler language than I do and in a much more straightforward way that will appeal to more people. There will be others who are who prefer to have their information in more of an academic or scholarly tone, who might be interested in the work that I do. Whatever it is, I hope that people who are interested in this information and do find nuggets of information that are useful in the work that I'm doing will help to spread that to others. But again, I can't possibly predict how that is going to take place specifically. All I know is that that if we do not get informed on these issues, and the various organizations like the Financial Stability Board, like the IMF and their special drawing rights, all of these various mechanisms by which these oligarchies are merging, if we don't find this information, if we don't spread this information, if we don't become aware of it, there is no chance that we will ever be able to counteract the narrative that's being constructed right now of this faux U.S.-China rivalry that is going to railroad us into a false narrative by which we will eventually arrive at that precisely that form of globalization we've been talking about. Whether the U.S. side of this U.S.-China rivalry wins out and it becomes an extension of the current Pax Americana, or if the Chinese side of this U.S.-China rivalry wins out and it becomes a brick-sled Chinese-style New World Order, quote unquote, then I think either way that it's still going to be the same oligarchy that is ultimately the power behind the throne and will ultimately benefit from the globalist institutions that result from that. So I think we have to recognize that the real choice is not between Chinese style globalization or American style globalization. It's between people interacting between each other in communities of interest, both online and offline. Versus this idea of these large, unaccountable international bodies that are going to be deciding things in closed-door meetings that you and I don't have any access to.
Well, James Corbett, I wanted to really thank you for joining us today. Before we let you go, did you want to share with the viewers where they can find you and any last thoughts you might have?
Well, the best way to find me is my main website is CorbettReport.com. That's CorbettReport.com. And if you just type China into the search bar, you'll find a number of different reports I've done, including that China and the New World Order podcast or the China and the U.S. Frenemies with Benefits article that we've been citing. There's a lot of different pieces to this puzzle. We've only scratched the surface of some of this information. So there are literally dozens and dozens and dozens of links to more information for people who are interested. And perhaps the most important point of all of this is that I don't claim to be some sort of God on high with all of the information. I see myself very much as part of a community, the Corbett Report community.